Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue our conversation about why no one predicted that Justice Scalia would become one of the most polarizing Supreme Court justices in U.S. history. Then, we'll look at how the last Supreme Court term has affected U.S. law. Last week, we began a conversation about how U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia became what many consider the most polarizing justice on the Supreme Court, possibly in U.S. history. With us now is Bruce Allen Murphy. Bruce Allen Murphy is a judicial biographer. He is a professor of law at Lafayette College, and his latest book is Scalia, A Court of One. Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, Bruce Allen Murphy. Last week, we discussed, judging from Justice Antonin Scalia's early life, that no one could have predicted that he would become this character that he is today. Let's start with a bit of an overview of what we discovered from last week. For example, he had never been so polarizing and so brash in his early life.
No, just the opposite, Maria. It's a pleasure to be back. What we discovered in his early life was that Scalia was a highly intellectual individual, very, very talented, able to really sort out very complex intellectual arguments, and had learned through a series of bureaucratic appointments how to use those skills to marshal the evidence to reach the result that he wanted to reach in order to serve whichever boss or whichever administrative position he happened to be working in.
He gets appointed to the appellate court, and he's still being an affable guy. He's starting to carve out his judicial theory here. We're starting to see it, but he worked well with the other side.
Generally, he did. He was appointed to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which is a real proving ground for a Supreme Court appointment. It deals with a lot of administrative law appointments and a lot of law positions. And he was on a court in which the most visible judge in the federal system, Robert Bork, had been sitting for some time. He was more senior. He had been mentioned for the Supreme Court back in 1974. He was older than Scalia, and it was widely expected that he would get the first Reagan appointment after Sandra Day O'Connor's appointment in 1981. For Scalia, this became something of a proving ground. He did get along generally with the other members of that court. He did have his moments. He used to write and argue in cases so vehemently when he really truly believed in those issues that some of his work was called the Nino Path. And he used to tell his law clerks to work very hard to get the right result because he said it isn't easy to get right. What he was able to do was work within that system and position himself well against Robert Bork. In one case, the Ullman case, dealt with an academic from Maryland who had been accused in an opinion piece by a columnist of being a socialist and had sued for libel. And Scalia was arguing that the First Amendment, free press, did not cover such opinion pieces, did not protect the press. But Robert Bork argued, using a different sort of sociological theory, that in fact opinion pieces were given wider coverage. And that one case separated Scalia from Bork and made it appear to the Reagan administration later on that he was a more pure conservative. All in all, this became sort of an intellectual judicial pose down for Scalia, using the term of bodybuilding. He was able to show the administration that he was younger, that he was in better health, and that he was a little better conservative, and, they thought, more affable. He was able to get along with the other judges.
Let's go to the appointment process and the vetting process and all of the factors that kind of came together to make him the candidate that would then get onto the Supreme Court. So we have Jones Day, his law firm, connections. We have the Italian-American bar, who is trying to create the path for him to get onto the Supreme Court. What else do we have?
Well, we have a complicated vacancy situation. You have the departure of Warren Burger. So now they have to appoint a chief justice. Now, there are a couple of ways that the administration can go. They can take somebody from within the court. They can take William Rehnquist, for instance, or they can take Sandra Day O'Connor. But if they do that, it means they're opening up another vacancy that will have to be filled. Or they can go off the court and take one of the number of people, and there were about a half a dozen people who had been floating around whose names were well known, Frank Winter, for instance, Robert Bork, among others, including Antonin Scalia. They could be appointed directly to the chief justiceship. fairly early on, the president decided he was going to go from inside the court, and he decided that he was going to go with William Rehnquist. So now what you're doing is you're trading a conservative for a conservative, and they're looking to fill Rehnquist's seat. And it becomes pretty quickly a contest between Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia. And there are a series of people within the Justice Department who begin looking at all of the cases, that's part of the vetting process, and trying to predict what they're going to get on the court. And they predicted that they would get a fairly consistent conservative on the court in Scalia, but they also said, you're going to get somebody who will be like the William Brennan of the conservatives. He will bring the conservatives together under William Rehnquist and will help to forge a powerful voting coalition for the Reagan administration conservatives for the next generation or so of judicial cases.
Now, you contrasted him a little bit with William Rehnquist, and it seemed to me from your book that all of his drama schooling, his great talent with drama, really paid off throughout this process.
Yes, it truly did. One of the things that he was able to do just before the appointment is he had a longstanding invitation to speak before an economic conference. He knew there would be administration officials there. He could have picked almost any of his speeches to give at that point. He had been giving for about a year a very popular speech about the problems of a legislative intent. He'd been arguing and argued successfully at that point in his career that court judges should not be trying to divine what Congress meant by the words of a statute by looking at committee hearings and by looking at the debates in Congress, that was an unreliable indicator of what the legislation actually meant. But instead, Scalia presented somewhat of a new speech and argued affably, it was a lunchtime speech, that Robert Bork had been talking about this notion of original intent, that you could figure out what the Constitution or the Bill of Rights meant by what the framers, the authors of those words, intended by those words. But Scalia said, you know, I don't think that goes far enough. I'm going to propose something called original meanings. Now, this was a term that he hadn't used in his 4 years on the district court, the Court of Appeals, rather. And it was a term that he hadn't really articulated and didn't really articulate it in that speech. He'd been using a series of other techniques, among which was textualism. I will look at the dictionary definition of the law or of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. And just, I think, that sort of branding of, I have a new theory, I'm different from Bork, may have helped position him just a little bit better, maybe 72 hours before the decision was made by President Reagan in the Oval Office.
It also seemed like he wasn't particularly honest in some of the questions and was able to hide this. I remember a question that you documented asked by Senator Biden, and he had essentially argued the opposite as what he said in that speech.
Well, what you have to remember about this is the nature of the politics. This is a pivotal time for the Reagan administration. Jan Crawford Greenberg has argued very persuasively in her book, Supreme Conflict, that had the Reagan administration picked Robert Bork for this first seat on the court with Rehnquist and then gone to Antonin Scalia, things would have gone better for the Rehnquist court because the Judiciary Committee and the Senate was controlled by the Republicans. And the questioner, the person leading that committee, was Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. So Scalia came into that whole process knowing, one, that the Republicans could provide cover for him, two, that the Rehnquist hearing had not gone well, and Rehnquist had a very tough time and ended up with 33 votes against him. So Scalia, I think this is what modern justices do in these confirmation hearings, found ways to finesse the issues and figure out how to get a record that would not provide objections to anybody that might cause a filibuster or some other major vote against them. The truth was, though, that the Senate by that time was exhausted and they just wanted to confirm somebody.
So from his very first case, his personality was the other one. We talked a little bit about the two different Scalias. It seems almost like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He automatically became a center of attention, monopolized the court. What happened?
Well, this is an interesting instance because political science and political scientists have gone to great lengths to write a number of really good articles and a lot of material about the judicial apprenticeship period. The theory is that when judges or appointees come to the court, they take a while to figure out what the job is. It's a very difficult job. Everybody says that it is. It's unlike anything that they've trained for. These are fantastically talented people, but they have to figure out how to work in a court of nine. They have to figure out how to work closed off from the political realm that helped them to rise to the top and get that appointment. They have to figure out how to deal with these issues that are way more complex than anything that they've seen in any previous position that they've occupied. And so usually, the theory goes, these people figure out who they should mentee to, who they should apprentice to. They figure out what position on the court, what wing on the court they should ally with, and they take a couple of years to take a breath and become a justice on the court. Scalia didn't think that was how he would do it. The fellow who arrived was not the Tony Scalia, the actor who was very affable, who the Reagan administration expected. He was the Nino Scalia, the really solid argumentation, win-it-all-cost type of person, who decided from the very first moment he was going to demonstrate that he was the equal of all the justices on the court, some of whom had been there decades longer than he had. He took over oral argument. He tried to make a point in a very minor case dealing with the inheritance of land in a Native American tribe that he had the correct theory that would solve this case. He knew the answer. And then when the case got into the conference stage and it appeared that the opinion would be written by Sandra Day O'Connor, again, there is a tradition that a maiden opinion is given to the new justice on the court. It will probably be a unanimous opinion. It's assigned by the Chief Justice. It takes a few weeks for that opinion to be assigned to the new judge, and it's usually the easy way to enter into this process. Scalia abandoned all of that and decided that he was going to take over this case. He was going to write an opinion that would try to gather up votes and steal the opinion away from Sandra Day O'Connor. And what actually happened is it took a case that probably could have been decided in a month or two, and it lasted for month after month after month. And Lewis Powell wrote on the side of one of the margins of one of the drafts of an opinion in the case, "This turned out to be a very unhappy case for us." I think from that very first moment, Scalia put O'Connor on guard that he was not going to be an ally of hers, and he put Powell and some of the other senior justices on guard that he was going to be a very challenging person on the court.
If you were going to assess Scalia's impact on the court overall and on U.S. law and jurisprudence after writing this amazing tome, what would you say?
Well, I would say three things. First of all, on the question of was he able to master the politics of the court, I think the answer is no. There were instances in which he was able to get five votes and change law. He was able to help elect George Bush. He was able to help craft a Second Amendment right to bear arms. His whole approach was one of the lone wolf of the Court of One. He would rather have written for himself than try to take patience and write drafts and compromise to get other justices on board. So many of his most dazzling opinions, I think, are his dissents. And those are the ones that are going to be remembered, and they may be the ones that if there's a conservative court down the road, they may be the ones that he's remembered for. That's one. Secondly, you'd have to say that his overall legacy of originalism is a substantial one. He has changed the conversation on the court. He's changed the agenda on the court. Even the liberals have to talk about originalism. But everybody's figuring out they can do whatever they want with originalism. They can pick and choose among the historical evidence. They can pick and choose which dictionaries they're going to use. They can pick and choose what definitions they're going to use. So I'm not sure that this is a process that will change the way decisions are made, but it's a process that probably will change the way decisions are explained. Thirdly, and this is, I think, one of the things that may haunt Scalia eventually, He came onto the court in 1986, and it was an institution that had largely shied away from extrajudicial works, from speeches, from writing books, from writing articles, from giving interviews off the bench, because they were still recovering from the 1969 forced resignation of Abe Fortas and the 1970 impeachment effort against William O. Douglas. Scalia set about immediately changing that standard and began giving speeches and then began roaming even more widely in those speeches until he was criticizing his colleagues, criticizing the court, changing the interpretation of the cases that had been decided that year, saying things like, the people who do not believe in my originalism theory but are living constitutionalists are the mullahs of the West, and their views are idiotic. Now, those are two different speeches that he gave those interpretations. And what it has done is it has put a partisan target on the back of the court and polarized it. And I think it's made it acceptable for people to attack the court. And when they do that kind of thing, the public support for the court has diminished. So I think that it will be a contest down the road as to whether or not the significant jurisprudential contributions of Scalia in his dissents and his originalism theory will outweigh the kind of political, partisan, foundational damage that he's done to the court in his nearly 30 years on the institution.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're speaking with Bruce Allen Murphy about the justice many believe is the most polarizing justice in U.S. history and how nobody predicted that this is who he would become when appointed to the Supreme Court. A couple of other things I wonder. One is he does seem to have had a meaningful effect on the law, particularly in his effort to incorporate religion into government.
It's true, and it depends on what side of the issue you come down on here. One of the real challenges is, does Scalia's originalism theory lead him to the correct answer on the question of religion in government? You have a debate that begins with David Souter in the Levy-Weissman case, the school prayer for graduations in Rhode Island. And the debate is whether or not Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in the First Amendment intended for accommodation between church and state, or did they intend, as Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists in 1802, for a high wall of separation between church and state that became impregnable. We have to recall that the framers are deists. They are not organized religion advocates. They believe in individual prayer. And it's pretty clear, I think, from the historical record that late in their careers, both Madison and Jefferson came to understand that there should be a separation between church and state. What Scalia has been able to do in the Establishment Clause area, he's been able to work with William Rehnquist, with other conservatives, and lower that wall and make it more acceptable for the town of Greece to say, we're going to have a prayer before our town council meeting, or for people to put a giant war memorial cross on Sunrise Rock in the Mojave National Preserve. That kind of thing has happened, I think, largely in response to Scalia and the other pro-religion conservatives arguing that there should be a lowering of the wall between church and state. He was arguing in 1990, if there is a general law of the state that covers everyone, that doesn't target religion, in that case it had to do with drugs in Oregon, then even religious groups must follow it. But, he said, there might be exceptions to that in which we will use a higher level of scrutiny and protect those religious groups. This is the case in the Hobby Lobby instance, because pretty much since that 1990 case, Congress has passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, Congress has passed the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. The Supreme Court has, in case after case after case, created new exceptions. The whole area of law has become almost like a piece of Swiss cheese, where there are more holes in which the religious groups are being protected by high level of scrutiny than there is actual cheese left of the original Scalia decision in 1990.
One area we also didn't cover is his fight with Catholicism, with one version of Catholicism, and this sect called Opus Dei. How does this all fit together?
Well, it's an interesting question. I had to look into the question of what would be the impact of the pre-Vatican II devout, conservative, traditional Catholic views of Scalia taught him by his father and by his family in the 1950s. And there is floating through the internet a series of articles and charges that perhaps Scalia is part of this very conservative group within the Catholic Church. I could find no evidence that, in fact, he was associated with that. In fact, the best source that I was able to find, John Allen, Father John Allen, said that he could find no evidence of it as well. But it raised for me a different kind of question. Scalia's gone to great lengths in a series of speeches to say it makes no difference that I'm a Catholic on the Supreme Court. I decide cases as a judge, not as a Catholic judge. There is no Catholic way to decide these cases. And he's very persuasive in making that argument from a logical standpoint. But if you look at the process that he uses of going back to original sources, of looking carefully at the meaning of the individual words, if you look at his originalism of returning to the sources, that's what Father John O'Malley uses to define what pre-Vatican II Catholicism is. They go back to a Latin-based Mass. They go back to the Tridentine Mass that goes back hundreds of years. And you have in Scalia a man who takes great pride in saying, the church, the modern-day church, opposes the death penalty. They want to sanctify life. That is what the modern popes are saying. But I go with the earlier millennia of popes, and I go with the eye-for-an-eye approach of the earlier Catholic Church. I am in favor of the death penalty, and so I choose to ignore the modern church and go back to the earlier church. And if you look at the social values issues that he is deciding in the death penalty, in the abortion rights area, in the gay rights area, time after time after time, his views are very consistent with what you would expect from a conservative, traditional, pre-Vatican II Catholic. And his process of using originalism to get there allows him to do it and say, I'm doing it as a judge. Look at my process. It's originalism. Oh, it just always ends up where the pre-Vatican II Catholic group would say should be their position. So maybe that's just a coincidence.
The other thing that you didn't mention about his impact on the court, I think, pertains to the decorum of the court. Would you agree?
I do. This is a real issue that I struggled with. Remember, I started my career looking at Felix Frankfurter. This is the way Frankfurter treated his colleagues. He had no trouble in criticizing his colleagues, but oftentimes he did it in letters. Oftentimes he did it in private conversation. What you see in Scalia, though, is a willingness to say things that are highly critical of his colleagues, things that would eventually drive away those moderate conservatives like Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy and David Souter, and put Scalia in the position of not being able to amass a five-vote majority. He says those things in his opinions. Very early on in the Webster case, the abortion case coming out of Missouri in 1989, Scalia wrote in a footnote that Sandra Day O'Connor's opinion was totally perverse, was irrational, and not to be believed. That kind of thing is going to have an impact. And he says these things in speeches off of the bench as well, saying of Clarence Thomas, I'm a textualist, I'm an originalist, I am not a nut. Or again, I mentioned the mullahs of the West. It was pretty clear he was also talking about his colleagues on the Supreme Court who believed in the living, evolving constitutional theory. This, I think, is unprecedented. Not even Frankfurter went this far. And it has to have an impact. You don't see the other judges doing a lot of this, but from time to time you will see creeping into their opinions an occasional word, an occasional phrase that you might not have seen in another day. The other day, in the earlier era, justices would say, my learned colleague, my brethren. They were very almost regal and polite in the way they ruled in cases. This kind of change in the etiquette and decorum of the court is something that lays at the feet of Antonin Scalia.
So he's really introduced an element of almost street fighting.
Well, and it's very consistent with the way he functioned as a college debater. This is how championship-level college debaters succeed. They call each other by their last name. You see Scalia do that. In 1992, when Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens opposed Scalia's interpretation of history in a relatively minor property case coming out of South Carolina, Scalia overnight produced over a dozen footnotes that were highly critical of his colleagues. And they understood that this was what one of the law clerks for Harry Blackmun called the evil Nino. And they knew there would be incoming fire when they had circulated that opinion. That's how Scalia operates. He operates in a win-at-all-cost sort of burn the bridges in the process of trying to get your views out there kind of manner on the court.
It is fascinating. It just seems like he was hell-bent on changing U.S. law in his own image and in his own theory, despite any of the others' perspectives. And, of course, as you said in your book, and today, really alienated his colleagues.
It's a court of nine, not a court of one. You need five votes to do anything. That's what William Brennan used to say. And from all of the epigraphs that I had for this book, and I had a dozen or more, it came down to the one that I used. Well, that's my view, and it happens to be correct. I think Scalia is absolutely certain in his view. I think he is inflexible in his view. He is not someone who's going to compromise or give in. And I think he's somewhat puzzled when you look at the interview that he did just last year with Jennifer Senior of New York Magazine. He's puzzled that people just don't agree with him because he knows he has the answer. He says, it's easy. I just look at my history and I have a result and I'm handcuffed. But somehow he's always handcuffed to that ideological, right-wing, partisan viewpoint that has a sort of religious tinge to it and gets him where he wants to go on the Supreme Court.
And he's so cushioned by having a Congress that is, in essence, protecting him with the ideology.
These are wonderful days for him. He's somewhat cushioned now since the appointment of Samuel Alito, changing the court significantly to the right by replacing the more moderate Sandra Day O'Connor. He's cushioned by the fact that they are voting at least in the conservative direction. But if you look at the two cases on Thursday, you see what appears to be a unanimous decision in the abortion clinic protest case and the recess appointment case, and yet there is a concurring opinion written by Antonin Scalia in both cases that reads a little bit like a dissent. Well, you got it wrong. You didn't go far enough with these issues. You didn't get the right answer. You didn't use the proper test. Let me school you in that process. So even in winning, he's not entirely comfortable and happy. These are his significant successes. He has a court that's going in his direction, but he will not accept any compromise from what he wants to do, which is to change those legal standards and change those decisions in the time that he has remaining in the winter of his career.
Bruce Allen Murphy is the author of Scalia, A Court of One. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Maria. It was great fun.
When we come back, we'll review the latest U.S. Supreme Court term and what it means for U.S. law. Stay tuned.
No, it don't.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Supreme Court has struck down President Obama's recess appointments. It upheld parts of the EPA's regulation and Fourth Amendment rights to our cell phone data. How has the last Supreme Court's term changed U.S. law? With us are three experts. Sanford Levinson joins us. He is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, and more recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Also with us is John Vile. John Vile is Dean and Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, and the forthcoming Reframers, 170 Eccentric, Visionary, and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Also with us is Stephen Griffin. He is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane Law School. He's the author of Long Wars in the Constitution and American Constitutionalism, From Theory to Politics. Welcome to the three of you. Great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. I thought we should start with what this past Supreme Court term really tells us. The Washington Post, the New York Times both call it remarkable in that two-thirds of the cases were decided with a unanimous vote. Is this really meaningful? And if so, why? Sandy Levinson?
I'm disinclined to think that it's very meaningful, though I can see that it's a very interesting factoid. What I think one has to realize is that the Supreme Court, for a number of years, has been dodging some very important issues where the court is clearly divided. From my perspective, it has more or less disgracefully refused to hear many cases involving the modern national security or national surveillance state, simply refused to grant cert. It has turned down some other cases that would certainly generate divisions in the court. I think the reality is that with some exceptions, and no doubt we'll talk about those exceptions, what the Supreme Court is doing these days is not of very much interest to anybody other than lawyers.
John Vile, would you agree?
Not sure that I agree completely. One of the interesting things is a number of the unanimous decisions have some pretty pungent concurring opinions. I was reading Scalia's, going to say dissent. I actually heard it described as a dissent in the abortion protest case. It reads like a dissent, even though it's a unanimous court agreeing with it. So there's still a fair number of divisions at work.
Stephen Griffin.
I agree a little more with Sandy. Not only the long-term point that the court's been dodging some cases, but it's just a short-term point that a lot of the really hot-button issues didn't come before the court this term, with the possible exception of affirmative action, but there was a strong dissent there. And when eventually, I assume, everyone assumes a same-sex marriage case gets to the court, I don't think you're going to see a 9-0 ruling. So this is just one of those observations where it's an interesting point, but it's just to mark time, and it applies to this term, but I don't think that, you know, predicts the future.
Would you say this is the influence of the Chief Justice Roberts then? This is something he promised, that he would bring more unanimity. Sandy Levinson?
Who knows? I mean, I think one would have to wait to see the papers of the justices, which will open long after I'm gone. Let me again throw out the possibility that one explanation is that a number of these cases are probably as boring to the justices and their clerks as they are to most of the law professors or lawyers who have to slog through them. So the incentive to dissent or to write a snappy concurring opinion just isn't there if you tend to shrug your shoulders and realize that there are always internal costs to be paid when you dissent or concur. It's better to write a memo to your colleague saying, fine opinion, sign me up.
Let's look at some of the cases specifically. John Vile, you mentioned the abortion case. This is a little bit of a change from what they had before we were allowed to have some kind of a buffer zone. This one's a little bit bigger of a buffer zone, but it was unanimous. What happened there?
Well, again, it was unanimous, but there was a very, very sharp concurring opinion. Basically, all of the justices were agreed, as I understand it, that you know, we had a fairly limited situation here. It was a public sidewalk, and I think that had a lot to do with it. It was not narrowly drawn, and Scalia is practically screaming, well, you know, it's not only narrowly drawn, but he's arguing that the court is still continuing to treat abortion protesters differently than they are protest in other areas.
The majority then said what about this? Did they not address that at all?
Basically, they stuck pretty narrowly to the law is not narrowly tailored as it could be, which is not uncommon in First Amendment cases for sure. But Scalia clearly wanted them to go much farther and say, you know, it's not enough to be able to come up to someone on a sidewalk and whisper that you think, you know, that there's an alternative to abortion. If you want to express a greater political opinion than that, the First Amendment protects your rights to do so.
And this was supposed to be an effort to also protect the women and the doctors and the employees from harm. Stephen Griffin.
I usually disagree with Judge Richard Posner, but I thought he had a good take on the decision and the online magazine Slate. I think it matters that we've been having the discussion on abortion for quite a while. Positions are extremely well known. What the protesters are trying to do is well known. And if you're going into a building seeking a medical procedure, you probably don't want someone talking to you. whether they're screaming or whether they're not. However, you know, the Massachusetts law made itself more prone to being struck down simply because a public sidewalk is more a traditional public forum and place of demonstration than, say, if it had been private land. But I don't see the opinion as being particularly earth-shattering for the ultimate question of abortion either way.
What about this issue with recess appointments? This is a practice that presidents have used for a very long time. The Senate was particularly hamstringing the president by not going into much recess. What about the court's opinion there, Sandy Levinson?
It struck me as exactly what one would expect from a Justice Breyer opinion, and I actually mean that complimentarily. Somewhat to my surprise, I've ended up as something of a fan of Justice Breyer, that I believe, ironically enough, like Richard Posner, who was invoked a few moments ago, both are self-professed pragmatists who really try to figure out as judges more or less what would work for the benefit of the country. Neither of them would take text as the end-all or be-all, but rather they try to figure out what's good for the country. And I think that what Breyer says is, look, presidents have been making recess appointments, giving a fairly broad definition of what one means by recess, for at least 100 years, and depending on the historical materials, you can go back well beyond 1921. The country actually benefits from the ability of presidents to fill vacancies. On the other hand, there's something unseemly about treating 3 days as a full-scale recess. So the Supreme Court simply announces, really illustrating Justice Brennan's old rule of five, that the Supreme Court can do anything at once if it's got five votes. They simply announce that 10 days is the constitutional minimal term for a genuine recess, unless there really is a national emergency or national catastrophe. All of this strikes me as very, very sensible, exactly what one would expect from a thoughtful judge trying to design a constitution to function reasonably well in the 21st century.
Would you agree, John Vile?
I would. I think this is a case where it was almost more important to make a decision than to make it right. I think Sandy is correct that it's hard to find a particular constitutional basis for the 10 days. And again, you know, if you want to look at outward unanimity with a fairly strong concurring opinion, Scalia thinks that there's a difference between a recess and an adjournment and would further make a distinction between intersession and intrasession. But in terms of coming up with a fairly workable rule, people now know one way or the other whether they can make a recess appointment.
All these years, presidents have been making recess appointments at various intervals, and this is the first time we get a specificity like this.
Absolutely.
Stephen Griffin?
I generally agree. Justice Breyer, by the way, used his opinion to make a little slam at Justice Scalia's favorite method of constitutional interpretation, namely originalism, and tried to use the opinion a little bit to say, look, there's another way to look at this, and originalism would sweep too broadly and make unconstitutional what's been going on for at least 100 years. And usually that does matter to the court in the past. It was a big win for what you might call the school of historical practice. But I would just add that this is one of those opinions where there's not only an enormous historical backstory, but there's a lot of political maneuvering going on in the present, which means the decision may not mean much one way or another because the Congress has, in effect, already tried to both block the president, in a sense, and reform itself, at least in the Senate. This is a Senate drama, although it involves the House as well, because the House can force the Senate to stay in session. This is an opinion where, in other words, you can't tell the state of play on the field by just looking at the opinion itself. You also have to take into account what Congress has done and what they probably will do.
In fact, they didn't consider these things, you're saying. They didn't really think out loud in terms of the political blockage that has been occurring.
This is a good illustration of how in the separation of powers area, the court can only do so much. If they did say the pro forma sessions are really sessions, okay, that is like a green light to the Senate. But the Democrats in the Senate have already reacted to that by making it easier for the president to get his nominees rolling, which is really all this is about. It's not really about the desire of a president to make recess appointments. It's about the desire of any president to get his appointments voted on. That's what it's really about.
Sandy Levinson.
I think Steve is absolutely right. And like a number of Supreme Court opinions, I think it remains to be seen whether this will be of primary interest to law professors for very particular teaching purposes, that is, contrasting purpose-oriented argument that Justice Breyer certainly focuses on against textual formalism identified with Justice Scalia, but it might not be of much interest to the public at large if, in fact, the Senate reform of its filibuster rules, by and large, takes care of the problem. I think, as is just very often the case with Supreme Court opinions, or for that matter, much else, we won't know for a while whether this is a really important opinion or merely an intellectually interesting one.
Another big case that came down, again, unanimous, was the Fourth Amendment case pertaining to searching cell phones without a warrant. This is another one that seems to have a lot of agreement on it, and there was some surprise, I think, about how it went. Stephen Griffin?
That's the case where I would most take the point of others who are saying, you know, isn't this remarkable that we have unanimity? I might disagree slightly with Sandy. I think the evidence has mounted that Roberts does care about this. People usually stick with their public commitments. And I think there was mounting evidence that he's been working as hard as at least he can to produce unanimity where it's possible. This is an area where arguably there actually is some bipartisan agreement that both the government has gone too far in a general sense, and also there's a specific problem with adjusting the law to things like cell phones. And the court comes down four square on the idea, we can't just let this pass and let the police do whatever they want. These are the equivalent of looking at your private papers. So it's like a moment where the court is coming together in a way where clearly the country is already going.
John Vile.
I have a daughter who's a prosecutor, and she's... This is really throwing some law enforcement officials into a tizzy. I agree with the decision. I think the difference between searching somebody's pocket and searching all the contents that one has on the cell phone is just monumental. But I found it a little disappointing, and I know the court, you know, tends to take a case at a time, but I didn't see any signals there as to does this invalidate every prior case where police perhaps, you know, arguably in good faith, have thought that they had the right to search cell phones. So, I mean, this is one where there are literally hundreds or possibly thousands of cases out there that could be affected, and I didn't see any indication from the decision how they're going to handle them.
Sandy Levinson.
One of the more interesting and controversial doctrines of the Supreme Court, going back now 40 years, involves their retroactivity jurisprudence, where they have said, well, if we're announcing a brand new rule, then you can take advantage of it only in the future, but if you were unlucky enough to be convicted under the old rules, tough luck. For exactly the reason that John indicates, I would suspect that the next big case will be about whether the police were perfectly reasonable in believing that cell phones could be searched 2 or 3 years ago, and so somebody's going to have to stay in the slammer, whereas starting tomorrow, everybody will be litigating this new case. I do want to say one thing, though, about the unanimity here. Linda Greenhouse, who covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times for almost 30 years and is now at the Yale Law School, had what I thought was a very incisive column in the Times where she said, look, one of the things that's working in this case, as was also true in the case involving GPSs, where the police put a GPS on a car, is that unlike in most criminal procedure cases, where most of the judges do not identify with the defendants, do not imagine that they could ever really be the target of overreaching by prosecutors going after bad guy criminals. All of them have cell phones. All of them can identify with the fact that all of our lives are increasingly on this very, very small computer. And just as with GPS, I think it was Chief Justice Roberts who said almost with disbelief during the argument, do you mean to say that you could put a GPS on my car and find out everywhere I went without getting a warrant? And the poor attorney arguing the case for the government had to say, yes, that's what it means not to need a warrant. We don't have to show anything to any judge. We simply have to be interested in where you're going. That, as much as anything else, might explain the unanimity that this they can feel themselves. Whereas one looks at a lot of their other jurisprudence in the criminal law area, and I must say there's a notable and stunning lack of empathy for the people who are actually the losers in these cases. Most recently, interestingly enough, where the ideological divide was very, very different from what one might ordinarily predict, the question whether children of aliens could tack on the time at which they arrived in terms of being eligible for citizenship on their own, or whether once they turn 21, if the national government hasn't responded quickly enough, then, in effect, they have to go to the back of the line and start all over for citizenship. There, Justice Kagan wrote the decision upholding what many people thought was a quite onerous interpretation of the statute, not a crazy interpretation of the statute, and the court generally defers to administrative agencies. But there, I think one of the things that is part of the background is that even if one or another justice might be able to imagine a poor wretch who is the victim of this interpretation of the statute, quite obviously no justice can imagine being in that position, him or herself. And that's just not the way with a lot of high-tech things.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're speaking about how the last Supreme Court term has affected U.S. law. Stephen Griffin, would you agree?
Generally speaking, yeah. I think I had my say on the privacy decision, but I am a little surprised that they're not a little more sympathetic toward the police. But, you know, I think they're taking the attitude, as far as what John Vile said, look, if this is a big problem, we'll find all about it later. And this happens to be an area of the law where the Supreme Court makes very fact-dependent decisions all the time, so they can carve out exceptions for the police later if they want.
What about this EPA case? Is this meaningful at all? Sandy Levinson?
It's above my pay grade. I talked to a colleague of mine who's one of the chief administrative law teachers in the country who is generally very pro-EPA, and he thought on balance that it was a big victory for the EPA, that Justice Scalia was actually quite correct when he said, look, we left them with something like 83% of what they wanted instead of 86% or something like that. But at least my colleague seemed to believe that the EPA should be celebrating.
Stephen Griffin.
I think that's about right. I think the EPA got most of what it wanted. I think the newspaper headlines were a little off on the recess appointment, saying it's just an obvious defeat for the president. But on the EPA decision, I think they got it right, that basically what the Obama administration wants to do can roll forward.
John Vile.
Again, I think I go with Sandy's original comment here that, you know, typically the court is going to defer to reasonable administrative interpretations of the law. And they didn't give Obama, as the headline said, completely what he wanted. But basically, he was able to accomplish most of it.
If you were going to look back now at the entire term and you were going to note that law has developed, what would you say we're seeing emerge, Sandy Levinson?
I go back to my original comment that if we look only at the court this term, we see it more or less treading water. One of the cases we haven't talked about, for example, the so-called Bond case involving whether a woman in Pennsylvania could be charged with violating a federal anti-terrorism law whose basis really is compliance with a chemical weapons treaty. There were people, including some conservative law professors, who really believed that this would be the occasion where the court would return to a case from the 1920s, Missouri versus Holland, and really rein in the ability of Congress to pass legislation as necessary and proper to enforce treaties if the laws invaded states' rights. And the court didn't do that. What the court did was to offer what may or may not be a particularly convincing construal of the statute to say ultimately that it just didn't raise the Missouri versus Holland issues. That'll be saved for another day. And so what some people believed would be a blockbuster case turns out to be of very, very little importance at all. Even the affirmative action case that came out of Michigan, though it clearly was important because of atmospherics, and it did generate a long and eloquent dissent by Justice Sotomayor, it's very, very hard to believe that many people were surprised by what the court did, given its general hostility to affirmative action in many other cases, which as a practical matter are more important than the Michigan case.
We also had the McCutcheon case earlier on in the year that I thought was pretty important to sort of continue this long line of hamstringing legislators' ability to make change in particular areas. It's like it's going on a trajectory. It was going in this direction in affirmative action as well. Similarly with campaign finance, we're seeing this gradual whittling down of legislators' ability to pass meaningful reforms. It seems like it just keeps pushing the direction a little bit farther and farther down to the right.
You know, affirmative action, I do think it's a little odd. When you combine that with last term's Windsor decision, it's almost as if Justice Kennedy is tap dancing as fast as he can to avoid finally crossing the Rubicon, the one in terms of same-sex marriage, a federal right to same-sex marriage. The other is presumably ending, as many people expect, the smart money expects the end of affirmative action. But it's striking to me that although he's no friend to affirmative action, he keeps walking up to the line and he's not willing to write the opinion that Thomas and Alito and Roberts and Scalia would all sign on to in a second. He's not willing to do that. I don't think he can avoid a decision on same-sex marriage from his perspective, but he's putting some of these other issues, it's as if he and maybe other members are trying to put off some of these other issues to not roil the waters any further, as they did with, for example, Citizens United.
And John Vile?
One advantage of that, recognizing, you know, deferring, is it does give some greater chance for popular sentiment to form. And not that every constitutional issue should be determined in that matter, but if, for example, the court had taken a major case on gay rights 5 or 10 years ago, and recognized they have taken some, but if they had taken the issue of gay marriage, it would be very much like doing Loving versus Virginia, you know, the interracial case, before you did Brown versus Board. So I think there's a little bit of wisdom there. The one other case that we haven't mentioned that I think is worth mentioning is the town of Greece in New York versus Galloway, where the court upheld a prayer at a public meeting. And what's particularly fascinating about that case is there was no mention, if I recall at all, of the Lemon Test. Very historical. And there's almost a parallel between that and the recess appointments case, where history seems to count, I don't necessarily say more than logic, but more than past precedents.
Thank you, Stephen Griffin, John Vile, Stanford Levinson. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, and more recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. John Vile is dean and professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, and the forthcoming Reframers, 170 Eccentric Visionary and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Stephen Griffin is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane Law School. He's the author of Long Wars in the Constitution and American Constitutionalism from Theory to Politics. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.